And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Ho, 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 Dave.
We're
at Merry Christmas. I hope your stocking was stuffed as well as the New York State legislature stuffed their stockings.
Very few people get stuffed that well.
$32,000 increase.
Yep.
In Pennsylvania, the minimum wage is 7.25, and nobody's talking about increasing the minimum wage in Pennsylvania.
No.
Seven and a quarter.
You know, politically, raising the wage of the legislature has always been the death knell of people. If it's done right, to oppose it politically at the next election. Pennsylvania years ago voted to do that. Unfortunately, the vote came at the end of the session, right in the middle of the night, and so it was called the midnight pay heist. And the legislature all got, a lot of them got defeated based on that. And after that, what they did in Pennsylvania was they established some sort of an automatic cost of living increase. And this year it became controversial. It went up because of inflation a tremendous amount. So the legislators never win on this politically, but they do win financially on these things. In New York now, $32,000 in one scoop is just an enormous grab. You'll see the shockwaves at the next election on that. They justified it by saying, well, we're limiting outside income sources, but still, the headline is what matters in those things. And you're absolutely right when you talk about that the sin of everything is that the minimum wage for the people who have to pay the taxes that pay for the $32,000, or in Pennsylvania, the raise. In Pennsylvania, the minimum wage is still only 7.25. And I'll be interested to see when the new governor issues his first set of, when he issues his speech after taking the oath of office in January and then issues his budget, whether or not he addresses that minimum wage. That was the thing that John Fetterman always talked about. And, it was one of his strong points. And I would expect that maybe when he takes office as the new senator, that might be the thing that he introduces first as a bill. Probably won't go anywhere right away, but at least he's on the right side of things. And we'll just have to see what Shapiro does. Shapiro announced his team this week for transition and going forward, and it's a pretty conservative looking centrist looking team.
I see 5 members of the team are people who were chief advisors and aides to Rendell.
Well, that was Rendell. I mean, despite how the Republicans try to paint him, Rendell was always a middle and sometimes to the right of center type of politician.
Well, and in addition to that, he's got this fellow Joel Greenberg, who is going to be in charge of education policy on the transition team. Joel Greenberg is the business partner of Jeffrey Yaz, whose whole point is to get rid of public schools.
Yeah, and I believe that the teachers' unions back Shapiro in this election, and this is not exactly the kind of payback that they should be getting. And Shapiro is smart enough to recognize that not only do they want to get rid of public education, but what they want to do is get rid of the unions, the education unions are among the strongest of the unions, who, you know, so that they don't have this organized opposition that could arise against Republican policies, libertarian policies. So it's a twofer. Not only are you funneling money to the private sector from the public sector, where most people do get an education, but you're also working to destroy unions.
It doesn't look good. It does not look good. I mean, as we've learned from the last days of the Trump administration, the people who run the place are important. It's the policies don't exist apart from the people who either push them or fight them. So if you've got people in, that you're putting in power who don't stand for policies that benefit working people won't see those policies enacted. It's just that simple. Won't happen. Can't happen. Who's gonna do it?
Yeah. I mean, just as a side note, you know, we talked about New York State and governorship. We saw this week that Kathy Hochul, the newly elected, the first time elected governor, appointed a Republican to the state's, it's their Court of Appeals. That's their equivalent of the Supreme Court. They label the courts differently in New York, you know? Mm-hmm. Those things matter when you have issues that come before them in terms of policy or in terms of elections and redistricting and things like that.
Of course it matters. It's hard to justify supporting a Democratic Party if their first effort is to reappoint Trumpniks or conservatives or business people, but not left-wing advocates and not representatives of militant unions. You know, working people in the country in the last year, you know, 43,000 workers this last year organized their workplaces for the first time. 43,000 is a lot of people.
Yeah.
71% of Americans are in favor of expanding union membership. 71%. We're not talking here about some kind of small group of people or some small minority. Don't forget, the Trump base is something like 18 to 22% of the American people, of the adult Americans. 71% approve that unions should have greater strength. Yet all we hear about is the right wing and their supposed great strength. How come we don't hear anything about the people who are working and who are looking to have a fair shake?
Well, it goes back to the messaging and the control of these think tanks and things like that. You mentioned this unionization. We saw this week that again at Geisinger, the big hospital in Scranton, the nurse practitioners and physician's assistants voted overwhelmingly, like 11-1 ratio, to join the union that's already there, which Geisinger had opposed for years and years. They have about 1,000 people now organized in the union that work at that hospital.
The hospital, and not only that hospital, other hospitals and ancillary institutions, is becoming Scranton's industry. Scranton has become a health center, health education, hospitals, right. Healthcare. That's where, aside from government, that's where the bulk of the employed labor force is.
Well, it's happened for years. I grew up in the Hill Section. I lived in several different houses or apartments, and every single one of them, whether I lived in the lower hill, the middle hill, or the upper hill, was within a block or a block and a half of a hospital. and they all grew in the time from when I was a kid. They've all expanded dramatically there. And, of course, now Scranton has a medical college as well. Mm-hmm. And then the universities, Marywood and the University, and even Lackawanna College, all feed into some of these healthcare professionals. They have training for them. The University of Scranton for years has had a wonderful program centered mostly around biology and chemistry that sent students to the larger medical schools in Philadelphia. They had a pipeline. Now, of course, they divide that up between here locally and Philadelphia. But it keeps growing. And yeah, the one downside of that, Jake, as happens in a lot of places, is that as the colleges grew and the hospitals grew, they destroyed the tax base of the homes and the apartment buildings that they tore down and took off the rolls of the city.
Right, because the hospitals are nonprofit, they're exempt from taxation.
Right, as long as they use the facilities for the nonprofit things. And also, you see still a lot of empty spaces that are there that they haven't yet built on. And those, you know, so you had an apartment building that was valued at X amount of dollars, and now it's valued as only an empty lot. So you can't tax it for, you know, as its maximum value until they do something with it. And if it's put into use as a, you know, a facility that directly relates to health, you don't get any taxes from it. And then the other thing, of course, is that all these facilities use up city resources. They run on city streets. If things occur in the city, they need policing for that. The roads need to be repaved because they get harsher use, all that stuff. The city bears the brunt of the cost of these things without getting the full benefit of it.
Well, the point is, of course, that these are not... economic development is not a local activity. This is a form of economic development.
Yes.
The state needs it. The country needs it. We need doctors. We have an enormous healthcare crisis. Right. We need doctors. We need doctors distributed in a better fashion. We need ancillary health workers. They have to be trained. It's a national problem. It's a responsibility of the national government and the state government to see to it that that happens, not Scranton's responsibility.
Yes, the cities themselves can't afford to do this.
No. And that is why when people say, oh, well, the big government, you got a big country. Naturally, big government. You have to consolidate your income streams. You can't expect tiny income streams to provide the resources for big things because rivulets are not oceans. Rivulets are not great lakes. They're rivulets, but a lot of rivulets make a great lake.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and toward that end, we saw this week that, as I said, the crowning jewel in Nancy Pelosi's leadership got through Congress, and that was this huge omnibus bill to fund the federal government and to do other things. And thanks to the fact that we have a congressman who's on the Appropriations Subcommittee, the 8th Congressional District is going to get a good amount of their funds. They're going to get over $50 million worth. And some of that is going to be distributed to these healthcare or to support healthcare. The University of Scranton is going to build a new building that's going to have some of that. That's how things really need to be or should be done.
Well, in fact, it goes beyond that. The university is nearly $53 million that Cartwright got for this area, for his district.
Right.
Of that amount, $17 million goes to the University of Scranton to, it's true they're going to build a building, but the point of the building is it's going to house programs to train people in the health sciences and in research for the health scientists and also for cyber work. And right. And another $2.6 million is going to go to Marywood for nursing programs. So in other words, this is federal money that is doing exactly what we were just talking about, helping to increase the employment and educational base for the healthcare industry in Scranton. Just exactly right.
Right. You know, years ago, when I was growing up, we used to have Scranton State Hospital, and they had a nursing school. And many of the nurses that in Scranton came out of that school. Years ago, the state got out of the hospital business. There used to be Mercy Hospital. They had a nursing school. Now it's nursing is being trained in other ways, and it's good. I'm glad that they're doing that at Marywood and the university and things like that.
It increases the proportion of students in the population. Aside from everything else, that's good. More people come in. That's good for local businesses. They got to eat. They got to do their laundry.
Right.
They've got to do whatever. I mean, it makes for a more vibrant economic area and a more vibrant cultural center.
And it keeps people in the area. People who grow up and get a degree, they don't have to leave to get a good paying job.
And it's only done because the government funds it.
Yes.
But there's another important point here, because we said Cartwright brought this home. You recall that's a new policy. This business of earmarks, this business of local congresspeople being able to promote policies that benefit their communities. The Republican legislature and the Democratic leadership also opposed that for the last, 15 or 20 years. Pork barrel legislation, terrible stuff, earmarks, terrible stuff. And if it was so terrible, two things were the result. One, local needs were not adequately reflected in passages of appropriations because there was no way to do it. And two, there was no way for the leadership in Congress to exert discipline over unruly members who wouldn't follow the leadership because they couldn't withhold the only thing they can withhold, which was benefits to the community that they were representing. So it was a slap against democracy in the name of fiscal responsibility.
Yeah. Of course, you have this whole cadre of people who say, I don't want anything from the government. They don't come here to get things done. They go to Congress to stop things from being done.
Yeah, for them, earmarks were perfect. Right.
Yeah, the earmarks are irrelevant to them.
They stand in the way of what they want to do, and they ruled Congress, that point of view.
Yeah.
Ruled Congress. But, people say that Lyndon Johnson was a great domestic president. He was a terrible foreign policy guy, but he was a great domestic president, and they point to his programs, which he was able to get through and Kennedy could not get through. But that was all because he was able to put his hand on some guy's shoulder and say, if you don't vote for this, you're not getting that.
Right. That bridge that you want in Iowa is not going to happen.
Yeah.
And, of course, then they got that. They were able to get rid of earmarks. Remember the bridge to nowhere in Alaska?
Yeah. Yeah.
It served like two people. That kind of stuff. And, of course, that's also takes leadership where somebody who's doing earmarks, like the speaker, has to say to a congressman, this one is a bridge too far.
Right.
We'll get you something else, but you can't have this. It just looks too bad.
Right.
And you'll see. But the flip side of this is how we pay for those things, the Congress does. And this week we had an example of how not to pay for these things when they disclosed some of Donald Trump's tax returns, which showed that his last year of the presidency, he didn't pay any taxes. He only paid $750 in taxes a couple of years. But the bigger...
Three of the 4 years he was president, he effectively paid no taxes.
Yeah,
$750 is no taxes.
Yeah. But the bigger issue is why. And what we saw is, what we found out is that for the wealthy or for those with complicated taxes, the IRS is just totally undermanned and outgunned. And they can't, they can't audit these people adequately or fairly. Now, of course, with Trump, one of the scandals is that they didn't audit him at all while he was president, despite the fact that the law says that they have to.
That's right. This is not a law that was passed when Trump was president.
No.
This law was passed 45 years ago.
Right.
And the presidents for the last 40 years were audited. But when Trump got into office, all of a sudden the IRS couldn't do it and didn't do it.
Right. Now, the...
And he's complaining that the IRS is after him.
Yeah.
I wish they were after me that way.
He lied about that. One of the things...
Oh, come on. Lied?
One of the things that the Democrats did in previous bills also was to get more funding for the IRS to update their equipment and to get people who are capable of auditing these ultra wealthy. I've seen estimates that they might lose over $1 trillion by phony or, you know, questionable, let me put it to you that way, tax returns that where they could recover money for deductions and offsets and things like that, that they just can't do. That they have.
You may be right about the $1 trillion, but what I do know is true is that the estimates have been that the amount of money that would be spent on the expansion of the auditors within the IRS would produce a 10 times return.
Right. 10 for one.
10 for one. Yeah. And the Republicans are saying, oh, they're going to hire 86,000 guys to come and audit you. No, that's not what they're going to do. They're going to increase the people who can audit, not on the score of 86,000. And most of the money is not going to be spent on increasing the workforce of auditors, but they will increase the workforce of auditors.
Yeah. And, and that's one of the things I've heard the Republicans say. One of their top agenda items is to defund the IRS again.
Right.
They've been doing that for years and years and years. Less and less money. The IRS gets less money now than it had gotten in the past, basically on a pro rata basis, just to satisfy their wealthy individuals.
To satisfy the Republican argument, the government shouldn't borrow beyond its means. So it shouldn't tax. If it does tax, it shouldn't collect. If it doesn't collect, it shouldn't go after the people who illegally withhold their payment. But they also shouldn't do anything to maintain the programs that the people count on as part of their social wage.
Well, that's the program of the Americans for Tax Reform.
Grover Norquist.
Grover Norquist, yeah. That's it. Make the government so small we can drown it in a bathtub.
Right, you know? Exactly. And it's all based on a messaging thing that's, as you would like to say, which builds on itself, and every step is false.
Yes. Speaking of every step is false, how about what we found out about that congressman-elect from New York, George Santos?
Oh, how wonderful. How wonderful. So, George Santos, right?
Right.
A guy who worked for Citibank. Except it turns out Citibank never heard of him. And what he claimed to work for when he worked for Citibank was a subsidiary of Citibank that they sold off 8 years before he claims he ever worked there.
He supposedly went to Baruch College. But
they have no record of his ever being there.
Right, yeah.
He claims to be Jewish, but none of his relatives, especially his mother and father, are Jewish.
He claims that they fled the Holocaust, and it turns out his family went to Brazil in the 1920s.
Right. And on and on. There's not one thing he said about himself that's true.
You wonder if his name is really George Santos.
Who knows? Who knows? It turns out he worked as a customer service rep for a telephone company in the period of time that he claimed to be working for Goldman Sachs.
And nobody knows where he got his money from to finance the campaign.
That's right. That's right. I don't say you shouldn't be a customer service rep, and I don't say customer service reps shouldn't be elected to the Congress. But he wasn't a customer service. I mean, he wasn't anything that he claimed to be. And what he is a Trumpist. That he definitely is. That's what he stands for.
Well, he claimed to be openly gay, and turns out that he was married to a woman.
Yeah,
who he divorced two weeks before he declared his candidacy. But yeah. the scandal of that is not just his complete fabrication of his life, but that the Democrats didn't bring this out during the campaigns in a sufficient amount that would have defeated him.
Yeah, well, you know, even if they didn't know all of these things, they knew some of these things because they were published by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Not all of them, some of them, but enough of it was published so that they could have just been hammering home about this. For example, the Holocaust survivor business, the false employment business. That was known.
Yeah. And this goes to how the Republicans can take a little thing and blow it up and make it into the worst thing in the world. And the Democrats, who have a lot of things, you know, can't blow anything up into a viable campaign. And they really need to work on this. They really do.
Well, how would they work on it? They have to change the mentality of the people who staff their campaign offices. And that's not in the cards. The people who run the campaign right. offices are the same people who ran them yesterday and the day before yesterday and so on. So they yeah. just keep doing what they did.
Yeah, and you know, and we're going to see, is Josh Shapiro going to be able to do these things? We'll have to see.
Going into it, looking at his transition team, as you pointed out earlier, it doesn't seem like these are the people who can do the kind of bold policy innovations that Pennsylvania needs. You can't have a guy who opposes public education in charge of public education and expect public education is going to improve.
Well, we had that with Betsy DeVos, right?
Exactly. A woman who believed the education department should be dissolved was put in charge of the education department. Guess what? Charter schools proliferated.
Yeah. And they're, you know, it's, and they're growing in Pennsylvania. And the other thing about them growing is they're not well regulated. A lot of them have seen monies disappear that is supposed to be used for the children and things like that. It's an unequal playing field between the public schools and the private schools.
And you have to have, the only people who can defend the public schools are the public officials. And if the public officials are for the private schools, then there's nobody to defend them.
Right. Well, and again, you've got to get effective unions that can not only try to work for better wages, but they've got to work for better messaging.
And they've got to have the kids' interests at heart. And to yes. be fair, the union, the teachers' unions, do have the kids' interests at heart. But they're always attacked by the right wing as being special interests. But the special interest is the teachers and the kids.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that special interest if education is involved?
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. We're almost done with this week. We're almost done with this year. Maybe next week I'll ask you to look back on the year and make some judgments about it.
Yeah. We have, when you talk about leadership, we had that example this week in Congress when Vladimir Zelensky spoke. Maybe we'll talk about him more next. You know, he was Times Man of the Year. But there's a guy who was a teacher, and you could see what he turned out to be. So,
well, what he turned out to be, according to Donald Trump Jr., is basically an ungrateful international welfare queen.
Okay.
So there you go. That's something to talk about.
It is.
See you next week.
We'll see you next week. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. And did you eat latkes?
Of course.
All right.
Of course, with applesauce.
Okay. You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.